simply smiled coquettishly and sipped from her own glass. She could feel the weight of his eyes on her breasts. It was like having unpleasant bugs lumbering to and fro on her skin. How long did this charade go on? Some tale-tellers had her putting an end to Grey Dick after the second toast. His, may your beauty ever increase. Hers, may your first day in hell last 10,000 years, and may it be the shortest. Others, the sort of spinners who enjoyed drawing out the suspense, recounted a meal of a dozen courses before Lady Oriza gripped the special plate, looking Grey Dick in the eyes, and smiling at him while she turned it, feeling for the dull place on the three. May your first day in hell last 10,000 years, Roland murmured. Margaret nodded.
Aye, and let that one be the shortest. A terrible toast, but one I'd gladly give each of the wolves, each and every one.
Her visible hand clenched. In the fading red light, she looked feverish and ill.
We had six, do you? And even half dozen. Has he told you why none of them are here to help with the Reaptide slaughtering and penning? Has he told you that, gunslinger?
Margaret, there's no need, Eisenhart said. He shifted uncomfortably in his rocker.
Aye, but mayhap there is. It goes back to what we were saying before. Mayhap you pay a price for leaping, but sometimes you pay a higher one for looking. Our children grew up free and clear, with no wolves to worry about. I gave birth to my first two, Tom and Tessa, less than a month before they came last time. The others followed along, neat as peas out of a pod. The youngest be only 15, do you not see it?
Margaret, she ignored him.
But they'd not be so lucky with their own children, and they knew it. And so they're gone. Some far north along the Ark, some far south, looking for a place where the wolves don't come.
She turned to Eisenhart, and although she spoke to Roland, it was her husband she looked at as she had her final word.
One of every two. That's the wolves' bounty. That's what they take every 20-some for many and many a. Except for us. They took all of our children. Every single one.
She leaned forward and tapped Roland's leg just above the knee with great emphasis.
Do you not see it?
Silence fell on the back porch. The condemned steers in the slaughter pen mooed moronically. From the kitchen came the sound of boy laughter following some comment of Andy's. Eisenhart had dropped his head. Roland could see nothing but the extravagant bush of his mustache, but he didn't need to see the man's face to know that he was either weeping or struggling very hard not to.
I'd not make you feel bad for all the rice of the Ark, she said, and stroked her husband's shoulder with infinite tenderness. And they come back betimes, aye, which is more than the dead do, except in our dreams. They're not so old that they don't miss their mother or have how-do-you-do-it questions for their da, but they're gone, nevertheless. And that's the price of safety, as you must ken.
She looked down at Eisenhart for a moment, one hand on his shoulder and the other still beneath her apron.
Now tell how angry with me you are, she said, for I'd know.
Eisenhart shook his head.
Not angry, he said in a muffled voice.
And have you changed your mind?
Eisenhart shook his head again.
Stubborn old thing, she said, but she spoke with good-humored affection. Stubborn as a stick, aye, and we all say thank you.
I'm thinking about it, he said, still not looking up.
Still thinking, which is more than I expected at this late date. Usually I make up my mind and there's the end of it. Roland, I understand young Jake showed Overholzer and the rest of him some shooting out in the woods. Might be we could show you something right here that'd raise your eyebrows. Maggie, go in and get your Oriza.
No need, she said, at last, taking her hand from beneath her apron.
For I brought it out with me. And here 'tis.
4. It was a plate both Detta and Mia would have recognized, a blue plate with a delicate webbed pattern, a for special plate. After a moment, Roland recognized the webbing for what it was, young Oriza, the seedling rice plant. When Cy Eisenhart tapped her knuckles on the plate, it gave out a peculiar high ringing. It looked like china, but wasn't. Glass, then? Some sort of glass? He held his hand out for it with the solemn, respectful mien of one who knows and respects weapons.
She hesitated, biting the corner of her lip. Roland reached into his holster, which he'd strapped back on before the noon meal outside the church, and pulled his revolver. He held it out to her. But first.
"Nay," she said, letting the word out on a long breath of sigh. "No need to offer me your shooter as a hostage, Roland. I reckon if Vaughn trusts you at the house, I can trust you with my Oriza. But mind how you touch, or you'll lose another finger, and I think you could ill afford that, for I see you're already too shy on your right hand."
A single look at the blue plate, the size Oriza, made it clear how wise that warning was. At the same time, Roland felt a bright spark of excitement and appreciation. It had been long years since he'd seen a new weapon of worth, and never one like this. The plate was metal, not glass. Some light, strong alloy. It was the size of an ordinary dinner plate, a foot and a bit more in diameter. 3/4 of the edge had been sharpened to suicidal keenness.
"There's never a question of where to grip, even if you're in a hurry," Margaret said. "For, do you see?"
"Yes," Roland said in a tone of deepest admiration. 2 of the rice stalks crossed in what could have been the great letter Z sub N, which by itself means both Zai, eternity, and now. At the point where these stalks crossed, only a sharp eye would pick them out of the bigger pattern to begin with, the rim of the plate was not only dull, but slightly thicker. Good to grip. Roland turned the plate over. Beneath, in the center, was a small metal pod. To Jake, it might have looked like the plastic pencil sharpener he'd taken to school in his pocket as a first grader. To Roland, who had never seen a pencil sharpener, it looked a little like the abandoned egg case of some insect.
"That makes the whistling noise when the plate flies, do you, Ken?" she said. She had seen Roland's honest admiration and was reacting to it, her color high and her eye bright.
Roland had heard that tone of eager explanation many times before, but not for a long time now. "It has no other purpose?"
"None," she said, "but it must whistle, for it's part of the story, isn't it?"
Roland nodded. "Of course it was." The Sisters of Oriza, Margaret Eisenhart said, was a group of women who liked to help others.
"And gossip amongst themselves," Eisenhart growled, but he sounded good-humored.
"Aye, that too," she allowed.
They cooked for funerals and festivals. It was the sisters who had put on the previous night's banquet at the pavilion. They sometimes held sewing circles and quilting bees after a family had lost its belongings to fire, or when one of the river floods came every 6 or 8 years and drowned the smallholders closest to Divar Titi Wai. It was the sisters who kept the pavilion well tended and the town gathering hall well swept on the inside and well kept on the outside. They put on dances for the young people and chaperoned them. They were sometimes hired by the richer folk, such as the Tooks and their kin, do you, she said, to cater wedding celebrations, and such affairs were always fine, the talk of the Kala for months afterward, sure. Among themselves, they did gossip, aye, she'd not deny it. They also played cards, and points, and castles. "And you throw the plate," Roland said.
"Aye," said she, "but you must understand we only do it for the fun of the thing. Hunting's men's work, and they do fine with the ba."
She was stroking her husband's shoulder again, this time a bit nervously, Roland thought. He also thought that if the men really did do fine with the ba, she never would have come out with that pretty, deadly thing held under her apron in the first place. Nor would Eisenhart have encouraged her. Roland opened his tobacco pouch, took out one of Rosalita's cornshuck pulls, and drifted it toward the plate's sharp edge. The square of cornshuck fluttered to the porch a moment later, cut neatly in two. Only for the fun of the thing, Roland thought, and almost smiled. "What metal," he asked, "does thee know?" She raised her eyebrows slightly at this form of address, but didn't comment on it.
"Titanium is what Andy calls it. It comes from a great old factory building far north in Kala Sen Cree. There are many ruins there. I've never been, but I've heard the tales. It sounds spooky."
Roland nodded. "And the plates, how are they made? Does Andy do it?"
She shook her head. "He can't or won't. I know not which. It's the ladies of Kala Sen Cree who make them and send them to the Kalas all round about.
although divine is as far south as that sort of trading reaches, I think.
The ladies make these, Roland mused. The ladies.
Somewhere there's a machine that still makes them, that's all it is, Eisenhart said. Roland was amused at his tone of stiff defensiveness. Comes down to no more than pushing a button, I imagine.
Margaret, looking at him with a woman's smile, said nothing to this, either for or against. Perhaps she didn't know, but she certainly knew the politics that keep a marriage sweet. So there are sisters north and south of here along the Ark, Roland said, and all of them throw the plate.
I? From Kala Senkri to Kala Divine south of us. Farther south or north, I don't know. We like to help and we like to talk. We throw our plates once a month in memory of how Lady Oriza did for Grey Dick. But few of us are any good at it.
Are you good at it, Sai?
She was silent, biting at the corner of her lip again. Show him, Eisenhart growled. Show him and be done.
5. They walked down the steps, the rancher's wife leading the way, Eisenhart behind her, Roland third. Behind them, the kitchen door opened and banged shut.
God's a glory, Mrs. Eisenhart's going to throw the dish, Benny Sleitman cried gleefully. Jake, you won't believe it. Send them back in, Vaughn, she said. They don't need to see this.
Nah, let him look, Eisenhart said. Don't hurt a boy to see a woman do well.
Send them back, Roland, aye. She looked at him, flushed and flustered and very pretty. To Roland, she looked 10 years younger than when she'd come out on the porch, but he wondered how she'd fling in such a state. It was something he much wanted to see because ambushing was brutal work, quick and emotional.
I agree with your husband, he said. I'd let them stay.
Have it as you like, she said. Roland saw she was actually pleased, that she wanted an audience, and his hope grew. He thought it increasingly likely that this pretty, middle-aged wife, with her small breasts and salt-and-pepper hair, had a hunter's heart. Not a gunslinger's heart. But at this point he would settle for a few hunters. A few killers, male or female. She marched toward the barn. When they were 50 yards from the stuffy guys flanking the barn door, Roland touched her shoulder and made her stop.
Nay, she said, this is too far.
I've seen you fling as far and half again, her husband said, and stood firm in the face of her angry look. So I have.
Not with a gunslinger from the line of Eld standing by my right elbow, you haven't, she said, but she stood where she was.
Roland went to the barn door and took the grinning, sharp-root head from the stuffy on the left side. He went into the barn. Here was a stall filled with freshly picked sharp-root, and beside it one of potatoes. He took one of the potatoes and set it atop the stuffy guy's shoulders where the sharp-root had been. It was a good-sized spud, but the contrast was still comic. The stuffy guy now looked like Mr. Tinyhead in a carnival show or street fair.
Oh, Roland, no, she cried, sounding genuinely shocked. I could never.
I don't believe you, he said, and stood aside. Throw. For a moment he thought she wouldn't. She looked around for her husband. If Eisenhart had still been standing beside her, Roland thought, she would have thrust the plate into his hands and run for the house, and never mind if he cut himself on it either. But von Eisenhart had withdrawn to the foot of the steps. The boys stood above him, Benny Sleitman watching with mere interest, Jake with closer attention, his brows drawn together and the smile now gone from his face.
Roland, I...
None of it, Mrs., I beg. Your talk of leaping was all very fine, but now I'd see you do it. Throw.
She recoiled a little, eyes widening as if she had been slapped. Then she turned to face the barn door and drew her right hand above her left shoulder.
The plate glimmered in the late light, which was now more pink than red. Her lips had thinned to a white line. For a moment, all the world held still.
Riza! She cried in a shrill, furious voice and cast her arm forward. Her hand opened, the index finger pointing precisely along the path the plate would take.
Of all of them in the yard, the cowpokes had also stopped to watch. Only Roland's eyes were sharp enough to follow the flight of the dish.
True, he exulted, true as ever was.
The plate gave a kind of moaning howl as it bolted above the dirt yard.
Less than 2 seconds after it had left her hand, the potato lay in 2 pieces, one by the stuffy guy's gloved right hand and the other by its left. The plate itself stuck in the side of the barn door, quivering. The boys raised a cheer. Benny hoisted his hand, as his new friend had taught him, and Jake slapped him a high five.
"Great going, Cy Eisenhart," Jake called. "Good hit, say thank you," Benny added.
Roland observed the way the woman's lips drew back from her teeth at this hapless, well-meant praise. She looked like a horse that has seen a snake.
"Boys," she said, "I'd go inside now. Where are you?"
Benny was bewildered. Jake, however, took another look at Margaret Eisenhart and understood. You did what you had to. And then the reaction set in.
"Come on, Ben," he said.
"But come on!"
Jake took his new friend by the shirt and tugged him back toward the kitchen door. Roland let the woman stay where she was for a moment, head down, trembling with reaction. Strong color still blazed in her cheeks, but everywhere else her skin had gone as pale as milk. He thought she was struggling not to vomit. He went to the barn door, grasped the plate at the grasping place, and pulled. He was astounded at how much effort it took before the plate first wiggled and then pulled loose. He brought it back to her, held it out. "Thy tool." For a moment she didn't take it, only looked at him with a species of bright hate.
"Why do you mock me, Roland? How do you know Vaughn took me from the Manny clan? Tell us that, I beg."
It was the rose, of course. An intuition left by the touch of the rose, and it was also the tail of her face, which was a womanly version of the old Henchicks. But how he knew what he knew was no part of this woman's business. And he only shook his head. "Nay, but I do not mock thee." Margaret Eisenhart abruptly seized Roland by the neck. Her grip was dry and so hot her skin felt feverish. She pulled his ear to her uneasy, twitching mouth. He thought he could smell every bad dream she must have had since deciding to leave her people for Colibrine Sturgis's big rancher.
"I saw thee speak to Henchick last night," she said. "Will you speak to him more? You will, won't you?"
Roland nodded, transfixed by her grip, the strength of it, the little puffs of air against his ear. Did a lunatic hide deep down inside everyone, even such a woman as this? He didn't know.
"Good, say thank you. Tell him Margaret of the Redpath clan does fine with her heathen man, aye, fine still." Her grip tightened. "Tell him she regrets nothing. Will he do that for me?"
"Aye, lady, if you like." She snatched the plate from him, fearless of its lethal edge. Having it seemed to steady her. She looked at him from eyes in which tears swam, unshed.
"Is it the cave you spoke of with my da? The doorway cave?"
Roland nodded. "What would you visit on us, ye chary gunstruck man?" Eisenhart joined them. He looked uncertainly at his wife, who had endured exile from her people for his sake. For a moment she looked at him as though she didn't know him. "I only do as Ka wills," Roland said.
"Ka!"
she cried, and her lip lifted. A sneer transformed her good looks to an ugliness that was almost startling. It would have frightened the boys.
"Every troublemaker's excuse. Put it up your bum with the rest of the dirt."
"I do as Ka wills, and so will you," Roland said. She looked at him, seeming not to comprehend. Roland took the hot hand that had gripped him and squeezed it, not quite to the point of pain. "And so will you." She met his gaze for a moment, then dropped her eyes.
"Aye," she muttered. "Oh, aye, so do we all."
She ventured to look at him again.
"Will you give Henchick my message?"
"Aye, lady, as I said." The darkening dooryard was silent except for the distant call of a rusty. The cowpokes still leaned at the Rumuda fence. Roland ambled over to them. "Evening, gents." "Hope you do well," one said and touched his forehead. "May you do better," Roland said. "Missus threw the plate and she threw it well, say I."
"Say thank you," another of them agreed. "No rust on the missus."
"No rust," Roland agreed. "And will I tell you something now, gents? A word to tuck beneath your hats, as we do say." They looked at him warily. Roland looked up, smiled at the sky, then looked back at them.
Set my watch and warrant on it. You might want to speak of it. Tell what you saw.
They watched him cautiously, not liking to admit to this.
Speak of it, and I'll kill every one of you, Roland said. Do you understand me?
Eisenhart touched his shoulder.
Roland,
surely, the gunslinger shrugged his hand off without looking at him.
Do you understand me?
They nodded.
And believe me.
They nodded again. They looked frightened. Roland was glad to see it. They were right to be afraid.
Say thank you.
Say thanks,
one of them repeated. He had broken a sweat.
Aye, said the second.
Thank you, big, big,
said the third, and shot a nervous stream of tobacco to one side. Eisenhart tried again.
Roland, hear me, I beg.
But Roland didn't. His mind was alight with ideas. All at once he saw their course with perfect clarity. Their course on this side, at least.
Where's the robot?
He asked the rancher.
Andy? Went in the kitchen with the boys, I think.
Good. Do you have a stock line office in there?
He nodded toward the barn.
Aye.
Let's go there, then. You, me, and your missus.
I'd like to take her into the house a bit,
Eisenhart said.
I'd like to take her anywhere that's away from you, Roland read in his eyes.
Our palaver won't be long, Roland said, and with perfect honesty. He'd already seen everything he needed. 6. The stock line office only had a single chair, the one behind the desk. Margaret took it. Eisenhart sat on a footstool. Roland squatted on his hunkers with his back to the wall and his purse open before him. He had shown them the twins' map. Eisenhart hadn't immediately grasped what Roland had pointed out, might not grasp it even now, but the woman did. Roland thought it no wonder she hadn't been able to stay with the Manny. The Manny were peaceful. Margaret Eisenhart was not. Not once you got below her surface, at any rate.
You'll keep this to yourselves, he said.
Or they'll kill us like our cowpokes?
She asked. Roland gave her a patient look, and she colored beneath it.
I'm sorry, Roland, I'm upset. It comes of throwing the plate in hot blood.
Eisenhart put an arm around her. This time she accepted it gladly and laid her head on his shoulder.
Who else in your group can throw as well as that? Roland asked.
Any? Zelia Jaffords, she said at once.
Say true?
She nodded emphatically.
Zelia could have cut that tater in 2 10-for-10 at 20 paces farther back.
Others?
Sari Adams, wife of Diego.
And Rosalita Munoz.
Roland raised his eyebrows at that.
Aye, she said. Other than Zelia, Rosie's best.
A brief pause.
And me, I suppose.
Roland felt as if a huge weight had rolled off his back. He'd been convinced they'd somehow have to bring back weapons from New York or find them on the east side of the river. Now it looked as if that might not be necessary. Good. They had other business in New York, business involving Calvin Tower. He didn't want to mix the two unless he absolutely had to.
I'd see you four women at the old fellow's rectory house, and just you four.
His eyes flicked briefly to Eisenhart, then back to Eisenhart's sigh. No husbands.
Now wait just a damn minute,
Eisenhart said.
Roland held up his hand. Nothing's been decided yet.
It's the way it's not been decided I don't care for, Eisenhart said. Hush a minute, Margaret said. When would you see us?
Roland calculated. 24 days left, perhaps only 23, and still much left to see. And there was the thing hidden in the old fellow's church, that to deal with, too. And the old Manny, Henchik. Yet in the end, he knew, the day would come and things would play out with shocking suddenness. They always did. 5 minutes, 10 at most, and all would be finished, for good or ill. The trick was to be ready when those few minutes came around. 10 days from now, he said. In the evening, I'd see the four of you in competition, turn and turn about.
All right, she said. That much we can do. But Roland, I'll not throw so much as a single plate or raise a single finger against the wolves if my husband still says no.
I understand, Roland said, knowing she would do as he said, like it or not. When the time came, they all would. There was one small window in the office wall, dirty and festooned with cobwebs, but clear enough for them to be able to see Andy marching across the yard, his electric eyes flashing on and off in the deepening twilight. He was humming to himself.
"Eddie says robots are programmed to do certain tasks," he said. "Andy does the tasks you bid him?"
"Mostly, yes," Eisenhart said. "Not always. And he's not always around, you can."
Hard to believe he was built to do no more than sing foolish songs and tell horoscopes, Roland mused.
"Perhaps the old people gave him hobbies," Margaret Eisenhart said. "And now that his main tasks are gone, lost in time, do you ken, he concentrates on the hobbies."
"You think the old people made him?"
"Who else?" Von Eisenhart asked. Andy was gone now, and the backyard was empty.
"Aye, who else?" Roland said, still musing. "Who else would have the wit and the tools? But the old people were gone 2,000 years before the wolves began raiding into the Kala, 2,000 or more. So what I'd like to know is who or what programmed Andy not to talk about them, except to tell you folks when they're coming. And here's another question, not as interesting as that, but still curious. Why does he tell you that much if he cannot or will not tell you anything else?"
Eisenhart and his wife were looking at each other, thunderstruck. They'd not gotten past the first part of what Roland had said. The gunslinger wasn't surprised, but he was a little disappointed in them. Really, there was much here that was obvious. If, that was, one set one's wits to work, in fairness to the Eisenharts, Jaffordses, and Overholzers of the Kala, he supposed, straight thinking wasn't so easy when your babbies were at stake. There was a knock at the door. Eisenhart called, "Come!" It was Ben Sleitman.
"Stock's all put to bed, boss."
He took off his glasses and polished them on his shirt. "And the boys are off with Benny's tent. Andy was stalking them close, so that's well." Sleitman looked at Roland.
"It's early for rock cats, but if one were to come, Andy'd give my boy at least one shot at it with his ba. He's been told so, and comes back, order recorded. If Benny were to miss, Andy'd get between the boys and the cat. He's programmed strictly for defense, and we've never been able to change that, but if the cat were to keep coming—"
"Andy'd rip it to pieces," Eisenhart said. He spoke with a species of gloomy satisfaction.
"Fast, is he?" Roland asked.
"You're a bugger," Sleitman said. "Don't look at Dewey, all tall and gangly like he is, but he can move like greased lightning when he wants to. Faster than any rock cat. We believe he must run on antinomics."
"Very likely," Roland said absently.
"Never mind that," Eisenhart said. "But listen, Ben, why do you suppose it is that Andy won't talk about the wolves?"
"His programming."
"Aye, but it's as Roland pointed out to us just before he came in. And we should have seen it for ourselves long before this, if the old people set him a-going, and then the old people died out or moved on, long before the wolves showed themselves. Do you see the problem?"
Sleitman the elder nodded, then put his glasses back on.
"Must have been something like the wolves in the Elden days, don't you think? Enough like 'em so Andy can't tell 'em apart. It's all I can figure."
"Is it really?" Roland thought.
He produced the Tavery twins' map, opened it, and tapped an arroyo in the hill country northeast of town. It wound its way deeper and deeper into those hills before ending in one of the Kala's old garnet mines. This one was a shaft that went 30 feet into a hillside and then stopped. The place wasn't really much like Eyebolt Canyon in Magus. There was no Thinny in the arroyo, for one thing, but there was one crucial similarity. Both were dead ends, and Roland knew a man will try to take service again from that which has served him once, that he should pick this arroyo, this dead-end mine shaft, for his ambush of the wolves made perfect sense. To Eddie, to Susanna, to the Eisenharts, and now to the Eisenharts' foreman, it would make sense to Sari Adams and Rosalita Munoz. It would make sense to the old fella. He would disclose this much of his plan to others, and it would make sense to them as well. And if things were left out? If some of what he said was a lie? If the wolves got wind of the lie and believed it? That would be good, wouldn't it? Good if they lunged and snapped in the right direction, but at the wrong thing. Yes, but I'll need to trust someone with the whole truth eventually. Who? Not Susanna, because Susanna was now two again, and he didn't trust the other one.
Not Eddie, because Eddie might let something crucial slip to Susanna and then Mia would know. Not Jake, because Jake had become fast friends with Benny Sleitman. He was on his own again, and this condition had never felt more lonely to him. "Look," he said, tapping the arroyo, "here's a place you might think of, Sleitman. Easy to get in, not so easy to get back out. Suppose we were to take all the children of a certain age and tuck them away safe in this little bit of a mine." He saw understanding begin to dawn in Sleitman's eyes. Something else, too. Hope, maybe.
"If we hide the children, they know where," Eisenhart said. "It's as if they smell 'em, like ogres in a kid's cradle story."
"So I'm told," Roland said. "What I suggest is that we could use that."
"Make 'em bait, you mean? Gunslinger, that's hard."
Roland, who had no intention of putting the Kala's children in the abandoned garnet mine, or anywhere near it, nodded his head. "Hard world sometimes, Eisenhart."
"Say thank you," Eisenhart replied, but his face was grim. He touched the map. "Could work. Aye, could work. If you could suck all the wolves in."
"Wherever the children wind up, I'll need help putting them there," Roland thought. "There'll have to be people who know where to go and what to do. A plan, but not yet. For now, I can play the game I'm playing. It's like castles, because someone's hiding." Did he know that? He did not. Did he smell it? Aye, he did. Now it's 24, Roland thought. 24 days until the wolves. It would have to be enough. Chapter 6. Grandpère's Tale. 1. Eddie, a city boy to the core, was almost shocked by how much he liked the Jaffords' place on the river road.
"I could live in a place like this," he thought. "That'd be okay. It'd do me fine."
It was a long log cabin, craftily built and chinked against the winter winds. Along one side there were large windows which gave a view down a long, gentle hill to the rice fields and the river. On the other side was the barn and the dooryard, beaten dirt that had been prettied up with circular islands of grass and flowers, and, to the left of the back porch, a rather exotic little vegetable garden. Half of it was filled with a yellow herb called madrigal, which Tian hoped to grow in quantity the following year. Susanna asked Zelia how she kept the chickens out of the stuff, and the woman laughed ruefully, blowing hair back from her forehead.
"With great effort, that's how," she said. "Yet the madrigal does grow, you see, and where things grow, there's always hope."
What Eddie liked was the way it all seemed to work together and produce a feeling of home. You couldn't exactly say what caused that feeling, because it was no one thing, but, yeah, there is one thing. And it doesn't have anything to do with the rustic log cabin look of the place, or the vegetable garden and the pecking chickens or the beds of flowers, either. It was the kids. At first Eddie had been a little stunned by the number of them, produced for his and Suze's inspection like a platoon of soldiers for the eye of a visiting general. And by God, at first glance, there looked like almost enough of them to fill a platoon, or a squad at least.
"Them on the end are Hedden and Hedda," Zelia said, pointing to the pair of dark blondes. "They're 10. Make your manners, you two."
Hedden sketched a bow, at the same time tapping his grimy forehead with the side of an even grimier fist. Covering all the bases, Eddie thought. The girl curtsied.
"Long nights and pleasant days," said Hedden. "That's pleasant days and long lives, dummikins," Hedda Stage whispered, then curtsied and repeated the sentiment in what she felt was the correct manner.
Hedden was too overawed by the outworlders to glower at his know-it-all sister or even really to notice her.
"The two young'uns is Lyman and Leah," Zelia said. Lyman, who appeared all eyes and gaping mouth, bowed so violently he nearly fell in the dirt.
Leah actually did tumble over while making her curtsy. Eddie had to struggle to keep a straight face as Hedda picked her sister out of the dust, hissing.
"And this one," she said, kissing the large baby in her arms, "is Aaron, my little love." "You're singleton," Susanna said. "Aye, lady, so he is."
Aaron began to struggle, kicking and twisting. Zelia put him down. Aaron hitched up his diaper and trotted off toward the side of the house, yelling for his da.
"Hedden, go after him and mind him," Zelia said. "Ma, ma, no!"
He sent her frantic eye signals to the effect that he wanted to stay right here, listening to the strangers and eating them up with his eyes.
"Ma, ma, yes," Zelia said. "Garn and mind your brother, Hedden."
The boy might have argued further, but at that moment, Tian Jaffords came around the corner of the cabin and swept the little boy up into his arms. Aaron crowed, knocked off his dad's straw hat, pulled at his dad's sweaty hair. Eddie and Susanna barely noticed this. They had eyes only for the overall-clad giants following along in Jaffords's wake. Eddie and Susanna had seen maybe a dozen extremely large people on their tour of the smallhold farms along the river road, but always at a distance.
"Most of them are shy of strangers, Yerken," Eisenhart had said.
These two were less than 10 feet away. Man and woman, or boy and girl? Both at the same time, Eddie thought, because their ages don't matter. The female, sweaty and laughing, had to be 6'6", with breasts that looked twice as big as Eddie's head. Around her neck on a string was a wooden crucifix. The male had at least 6 inches on his sister-in-law. He looked at the newcomers shyly, then began sucking his thumb with one hand and squeezing his crotch with the other. To Eddie, the most amazing thing about them wasn't their size, but their eerie resemblance to Tian and Zelia. It was like looking at the clumsy first drafts of some ultimately successful work of art. They were so clearly idiots, the both of them, and so clearly, so closely related to people who weren't. Eerie was the only word for them. "No," Eddie thought. "The word is runt."
"This is my brother Zalman," Zelia said, her tone oddly formal.
"And my sister Tia," Tian added. "Make your manners, you two galoots."
Zalman just went ahead sucking one piece of himself and kneading the other. Tia, however, gave a huge and somehow duck-like curtsy.
"Long days, long nights, long earth," she cried. "We get taters and gravy."
"Good," Susanna said quietly. "Taters and gravy is good."
"Taters and gravy is good."
Tia wrinkled her nose, pulling her upper lip away from her teeth in a pig-like sneer of good fellowship. "Taters and gravy, taters and gravy, good old taters and gravy."
Hedda touched Susanna's hand hesitantly.
"She go on like that all day unless you tell her shush, Mrs. Sy."
"Shush, Tia," Susanna said.
Tia gave a honk of laughter at the sky, crossed her arms over her prodigious bosom, and fell silent.
"Zal," Tian said, "you need to go pee-pee, don't you?"
Zalia's brother said nothing, only continued squeezing his crotch.
"Go pee-pee," Tian said. "You go on behind the barn. Water the sharp root. Say thank you."
For a moment, nothing happened. Then Zalman set off, moving in a wide, shambling gait.
"When they were young," Susanna began. "Bright as polished agates, the both of them," Zelia said. "Now she's bad and my brother's even worse."
She abruptly put her hands over her face. Aaron gave a high laugh at this and covered his own face in imitation.
"Peterboo,"
he called through his fingers, but both sets of twins looked grave, alarmed even.
"What's wrong at Mama?" Lyman asked, tugging at his father's pants leg.
Zalman, heedless of all, continued toward the barn, still with one hand in his mouth and the other in his crotch.
"Nothing, son. Your mama's all right."
Tian put the baby down, then ran his arm across his eyes. "Everything's fine. Ain't it, Z?"
"Aye," she said, lowering her hands.
The rims of her eyes were red, but she wasn't crying.
"And with the blessing, what ain't fine will be."
"From your lips to God's ear," Eddie said, watching the giant shamble toward the barn. "From your lips to God's ear."
2.
"Is he having one of his bright days, your grandpere?" Eddie asked Tian a few minutes later. They had walked around to where Tian could show Eddie the field he called son of a bitch, leaving Zelia and Susanna with all children, great and small.
"Not so's you'd notice," Tian said, his brow darkening. "He ain't half-addled these last few years and won't have nobbut to do with me anyway." "Her, aye, because she'll hand-feed him, then wipe the drool off his chin for him and tell him thank you. Ain't enough I got two great runt galoots to feed, is it? I've got to have that bad-natured old man as well. Head's gone as rusty as an old hinge. Half the time he don't even know where he is, say any small, small."
They walked, high grass swishing against their pants.
Twice Eddie almost tripped over rocks, and once Tien seized his arm and led him around what looked like a right leg smasher of a hole. No wonder he calls it son of a bitch, Eddie thought. And yet there were signs of cultivation. Hard to believe anyone could pull a plow through this mess, but it looked as if Tien Jaffords had been trying.
If your wife's right, I think I need to talk to him, Eddie said. Need to hear his story.
My granddad's got stories, all right, 50,000. Trouble is, most of them was lies from the start, and now he gets them all mixed up together. His accent were always thick, and these last 3 years he's missing his last 3 teeth as well. Likely you won't be able to understand his nonsense to begin with. I wish you joy of him, Eddie of New York.
What the hell did he do to you, Tien?
'Twasn't what he did to me, but what he did to my da. That's a long story and nothing to do with this business. Leave it.
No, you leave it, Eddie said, coming to a stop.
Tien looked at him, startled. Eddie nodded, unsmiling. You heard me. He was 25, already a year older than Cuthbert Allgood on his last day at Jericho Hill, but in this day's failing light, he could have passed for a man of 50, one of harsh certainty. If he's seen a dead wolf, we need to debrief him.
I don't ken it, Eddie.
Yeah, but I think you ken my point just fine. Whatever you've got against him, put it aside. If we settle up with the wolves, you have my permission to bump him into the fireplace or push him off the goddamn roof, but for now, keep your sore ass to yourself, okay?
Tien nodded. He stood looking out across his troublesome north field, the one he called son of a bitch, with his hands in his pockets. When he studied it so, his expression was one of troubled greed.
Do you think his story about killing a wolf is so much hot air? If you really do, I won't waste my time.
Grudgingly, Tien said, I'm more apt to believe that one than most of the others.
Why?
Well, he were telling it ever since I were old enough to listen. And that one never changes much. Also,
Tien's next words squeezed down as if he were speaking them through gritted teeth.
My grandpere never had no shortage of thorn and bark. If anyone would have had guts enough to go out on the East Road and stand against the wolves, not to mention enough trum to get others to go with him, I'd bet my money on Jamie Jaffords.
Trum?
Tien thought about how to explain it. If he was to stick your head in a rock cat's mouth, that'd take courage, wouldn't it?
It would take idiocy, was what Eddie thought, but he nodded.
If you was the sort of man could convince someone else to stick his head in a rock cat's mouth, that'd make your trum, your din's trum, ain't he?
Eddie remembered some of the stuff Roland had gotten him to do, and nodded. Roland was trum, all right. He was trum as hell. Eddie was sure the gunslinger's old mates would have said the same.
Aye, Tien said, turning his gaze back to his field. In any case, if you'd get something halfway sensible out of the old man, I'd wait until after supper. He brightens a bit once he's had his rations and half a pint of graff. And make sure my wife's sitting right beside you, where he can get an eyeful. I imagine he'd try to have a good deal more than his eye on her, were he a younger man.
His face had darkened again. Eddie clapped him on the shoulder.
Well, he's not younger. You are. So lighten up, all right?
Aye.
Tien made a visible effort to do just that.
What do you think of my field, gunslinger? I'm going to plant it with madrigal next year, the yellow stuff you saw out front.
What Eddie thought was that the field looked like a heartbreak waiting to happen. He suspected that down deep, Tien thought about the same. You didn't call your only unplanted field son of a bitch because you expected good things to happen there. But he knew the look on Tien's face. It was the one Henry used to get when the two of them were setting off to score. It was always going to be the best stuff this time, the best stuff ever, China white, and never mind that Mexican brown that made your head ache and your bowels run. They'd get high for a week, the best high ever, mellow, and then quit the junk for good. That was Henry's scripture, and it could have been Henry here beside him, telling Eddie what a fine cash crop madrigal was, and how the people who told him you couldn't grow it this far north would be laughing on the other side of their faces come next reap. And then he'd buy Hugh Anselm's field over on the far side of yon ridge, hire a couple of extra men, come reap, for the land'd be gold for as far as you could see. Why, he might even quit the rice altogether and become a madrigal monarch.
Eddie nodded toward the field, which was hardly half turned.
Looks like slow plowing, though. You must have to be damn careful with the mules.
Tien gave a short laugh.
I'd not risk a mule out here, Eddie.
Then what?
I plow my sister.
Eddie's jaw dropped.
You're shitting me.
Not at all. I'd plow Zal, too. He's bigger, as you saw, and even stronger, but not as bright. More trouble than it's worth. I've tried.
Eddie shook his head, feeling dazed. Their shadows ran out long over the lumpy earth with its crop of weed and thistle.
But, man, she's your sister.
Aye, and what else would she do all day? Sit outside the barn door and watch the chickens? Sleep more and more hours and only get up for her taters and gravy?
This is better, believe me. She don't mind it. It's terrible hard to get her to plow straight, even when there ain't a plowbuster of a rock or a hole every 8 or 10 steps, but she pulls like the devil and laughs like a loon.
What convinced Eddie was the man's earnestness. There was no defensiveness in it, not that he could detect.
Sides, she'll likely be dead in another 10 year anyway. Let her help while she can, I say. And Zelia feels the same.
Okay, but why don't you get Andy to do at least some of the plowing? I bet it'd go faster if you did. All you guys with the smallhold farms could share him. Ever think of that? He could plow your fields, dig your wells, raise a barn roof beam all by himself. And you'd save on taters and gravy.
He clapped Tien on the shoulder again. That's got to do you fine.
Tien's mouth quirked.
It's a lovely dream, all right.
Doesn't work, huh? Or rather, he doesn't work?
Some things he'll do, but plowing fields and digging wells ain't among them. You ask him, and he'll ask you for your password. When you have no password to give him, he'll ask you if you'd like to retry, and then he tells you you're shit out of luck because of Directive 19.
If you knew, why did you ask?
I knew he was that way about the wolves because I asked him. I didn't know it extended to all this other stuff.
Tien nodded.
He's really not much help, and he can be tiresome. If you don't ken that now, you will if you stay long. But he does tell us when the wolves are on their way. And for that we all say thank you.
Eddie actually had to bite off the question that came to his lips. Why did they thank him when his news was good for nothing except making them miserable? Of course, this time there might be more to it. This time, Andy's news might actually lead to a change. Was that what Mr. You Will Meet an Interesting Stranger had been angling for all along? Getting the Falcon to stand up on their hind legs and fight? Eddie recalled Andy's decidedly smarmy smile and found such altruism hard to swallow. It wasn't fair to judge people, or even robots maybe, by the way they smiled or talked. And yet everybody did it. Now that I think about it, what about his voice? What about that smug little I know and you don't thing he's got going on? Or am I imagining that too? The hell of it was, he didn't know.
3. The sound of Susanna's singing voice, accompanied by the giggles of the children, all children great and small, drew Eddie and Tien back around to the other side of the house. Zalman was holding one end of what looked like a stock rope, Tia had the other. They were turning it in lazy loops with large, delighted grins on their faces, while Susanna, sitting propped on the ground, recited a skip-rope rhyme Eddie vaguely remembered. Zelia and her 4 older children were jumping in unison, their hair rising and falling. Baby Aaron stood by, his diaper now sagging almost to his knees. On his face was a huge, delighted grin. He made rope-twirling motions with one chubby fist.
Pinky Pauper came a-calling, into sin that boy be falling. I caught him creeping, 1, 2, 3, he's as wicked as can be. Faster, Zalman, faster, Tia, come on, make him really jump to it.
Tia spun her end of the rope faster at once, and a moment later Zalman caught up with her. This was apparently something he could do. Laughing, Susanna chanted faster.
Pinky Pauper took her measure, that bad boy done took her treasure. 4, 5, 6, or up to 7, that bad boy won't go to heaven. Yow, Zelia, I see your knees, girl. Faster, you guys, faster.
The 4 twins jumped like shuttlecocks, Hedden tucking his fists into his armpits and doing a buck and wing. Now that they had gotten over the awe which had made them clumsy, the 2 younger kids jumped in limber, spooky harmony. Even their hair seemed to fly up in the same clumps. Eddie found himself remembering the Tavery twins, whose very freckles had looked the same.
Pinky, Pinky Pauper!
Then she stopped.
Shoo, fly, Eddie, I can't remember anymore.
Faster, you guys, Eddie said to the giants turning the skip rope. They did as he said.
Tia hee-hawing up at the fading sky. Eddie measured the spin of the rope with his eyes, moving backward and forward at the knees, timing it. He put his hand on the butt of Roland's gun to make sure it wouldn't fly free.
"Eddie, Dean, you can't never," Susanna cried, laughing.
But the next time the rope flew up, he did, jumping in between Hedda and Hedda's mother. He faced Zelia, whose face was flushed and sweating, jumping with her in perfect harmony. Eddie chanted the one verse that survived in his memory. To keep it in time, he had to go almost as fast as a county fair auctioneer. He didn't realize until later that he had changed the bad boy's name, giving it a twist that was pure Brooklyn.
"Piggy Pecker picked my pocket, took my baby's silver locket, caught him sleeping, 8, 9, 10, stole that locket back again. Go, you guys, spin it!"
They did, twirling the rope so fast it was almost a blur. In a world that now appeared to be going up and down on an invisible pogo stick, he saw an old man with flyaway hair and grizzled sideburns come out on the porch like a hedgehog out of its hole, thumping along on an ironwood cane. "Hello, grandpere," he thought, then dismissed the old man for the time being. All he wanted to do right now was keep his footing and not be the one who fucked the spin. As a little kid, he'd always loved jumping rope and always hated the idea that he had to give it over to the girls once he went to Roosevelt Elementary, or be damned forever as a sissy. Later in high school phys ed, he had briefly rediscovered the joys of jump rope, but never had there been anything like this. It was as if he had discovered, or rediscovered, some practical magic that bound his and Susanna's New York lives to this other life in a way that required no magic doors or magic balls, no toadash state. He laughed deliriously and began to scissor his feet back and forth. A moment later, Zelia Jaffords was doing the same, mimicking him step for step. It was as good as the rice dance, maybe better because they were all doing it in unison. Certainly, it was magic for Susanna, and of all the wonders ahead and behind, those few moments in the Jaffords' dooryard always maintained their own unique luster. Not two of them jumping in tandem, not even four, but six of them, while the two great grinning idiots spun the rope as fast as their slab-like arms would allow. Tian laughed and stomped his shore boots and cried, "That beats the drum, don't it, just, you're bugger!" And from the porch, his grandfather gave out a laugh so rusty that Susanna had to wonder how long ago he had laid that sound away in mothballs. For another 5 seconds or so, the magic held. The jump rope spun so rapidly, the eye lost it, and it existed as nothing but a whirring sound like a wing. The half-dozen within that whirring, from Eddie, the tallest at Zalman's end, to pudgy little Lyman at Tia's, rose and fell like pistons in a machine. Then the rope caught on someone's heel, Hedden's, it looked like to Susanna, although later all would take the blame so none had to feel bad, and they sprawled in the dust, gasping and laughing. Eddie, clutching his chest, caught Susanna's eye.
"I'm having a heart attack, sweetheart. You better call 911.
She hoisted herself over to where he lay and put her head down so she could kiss him.
"No, you're not," she said, "but you're attacking my heart, Eddie Dean. I love you."
He gazed up at her seriously from the dust of the dooryard. He knew that however much she might love him, he would always love her more. And as always when he thought these things, the premonition came that Ka was not their friend, that it would end badly between them. "If it's so, then your job is to make it as good as it can be for as long as it can be. Will you do your job, Eddie?"
"With greatest pleasure," he said.
She raised her eyebrows.
"Do ya?"
she said. "Kala talk for beg pardon?"
"I do," he said, grinning. "Believe me, I do."
He put an arm around her neck, pulled her down, kissed her brow, her nose, and finally her lips. The twins laughed and clapped. The baby chortled, and on the porch, old Jamie Jaffords did the same. 4. All of them were hungry after their exercise, and with Susanna helping from her chair, Zelia Jaffords laid a huge meal on the long trestle table out behind the house. The view was a winner in Eddie's opinion. At the foot of the hill was what he took to be some especially hardy type of rice, now grown to the height of a tall man's shoulder. Beyond it, the river glowed with sunset light.
"Set us on with a word, Z, if you would," Tian said.
She looked pleased at that. Susanna told Eddie later that Tian hadn't thought much of his wife's religion, but that seemed to have changed since Père Callahan's unexpected support of Tian at the town gathering hall.
"Bow your heads, children."
4 heads dropped, 6, counting the big ones. Lyman and Leah had their eyes squinched so tightly shut that they looked like children suffering terrible headaches. They held their hands, clean and glowing pink from the pump's cold gush, out in front of them.
"Bless this food to our use, Lord, and make us grateful. Thank you for our company. May we do him fine, and may us. Deliver us from the terror that flies at noonday and the one that creeps at night. We say thank ye."
"Thank ye,"
cried the children, Tia almost loudly enough to rattle the windows.
"Name of God, the Father, and his Son, the man Jesus," she said.
"Man Jesus,"
cried the children. Eddie was amused to see that Grandpère, who sported a crucifix nearly as large as those worn by Zalman and Tia, sat with his eyes open, peacefully picking his nose during the prayers.
"Amen.
Amen. Taters,"
cried Tia. 5. Tian sat at one end of the long table, Zalia at the other. The twins weren't shunted off to the ghetto of a kiddie table, as Susanna and her cousins always had been at family gatherings, and how she had hated that, but seated a row on one side with the older two flanking the younger pair. Hedden helped Leah, Hedda helped Lyman. Susanna and Eddie were seated side by side across from the kids, with one young giant to Susanna's left and the other to Eddie's right. The baby did fine, first on his mother's lap and then, when he grew bored with that, on his father's. The old man sat next to Zalia, who served him, cut his meat small, and did indeed wipe his chin when the gravy ran down. Tian glowered at this in a sulky way, which Eddie felt did him little credit, but he kept his mouth shut except once to ask his grandfather if he wanted more bread.
"My arm still works if I do,"
the old man said, and snatched up the bread basket to prove it. He did this smartly for a gent of advanced years, then spoiled the impression of briskness by overturning the jam cruet.
"Slag it,"
he cried. The 4 children looked at each other with round eyes, then covered their mouths and giggled. Tia threw back her head and honked at the sky. One of her elbows caught Eddie in the ribs and almost knocked him off his chair.
"Wish you wouldn't speak so in front of the children," Zalia said, righting the cruet.
"Cry her pardon,"
Grandpère said. Eddie wondered if he would have managed such winning humility if his grandson had been the one to reprimand him.
"Let me help you to a little of that, Grandpère," Susanna said, taking the jam from Zalia. The old man watched her with moist, almost worshipful eyes.
"Ain't seen a true brown woman in, oh, I'd have to say 40 year,
Grandpère told her.
"Used to be they'd come on the Lake Mart butts, but no more."
When Grandpère said boats, it came out butts.
"I hope it doesn't come as too much of a shock to find out we're still around," Susanna said, and gave him a smile.
The old fellow responded with a goaty, toothless grin. The steak was tough, but tasty. The corn almost as good as that in the meal Andy had prepared near the edge of the woods. The bowl of taters, although almost the size of a wash basin, needed to be refilled twice, the gravy boat 3 times, but to Eddie, the true revelation was the rice. Zalia served 3 different kinds, and as far as Eddie was concerned, each one was better than the last. The Jaffordses, however, ate it almost absent-mindedly, the way people drink water in a restaurant. The meal ended with an apple cobbler, and then the children were sent off to play. Grandpère put on the finishing touch with a ringing belch.
"Say thank ye,"
he told Zalia, and tapped his throat 3 times.
"Fine as ever was ye."
"It does me good to see you eat so, Dad," she said.
Tian grunted, then said,
"Dad, these 2 would speak to you of the wolves."
"Just Eddie, if it do ye," Susanna said with quick decisiveness. "I'll help you clear the table and wash the dishes." "There's no need," Zalia said.
Eddie thought the woman was sending Susanna a message with her eyes. "Stay, he likes you." But Susanna either didn't see it or elected to ignore it.
"Not at all," she said, transferring herself to her wheelchair with the ease of long experience. "You'll talk to my man, won't you, Si Jaffords?"
All that was long ago and by the way, the old man said, but he didn't look unwilling. Don't know if I can. My mind done hold a tale like it used to. But I'd hear what you do remember, Eddie said, every word.
Tia honked laughter as if this were the funniest thing she'd ever heard. Zal did likewise, then scooped the last bit of mashed potato out of the bowl with a hand nearly as big as a cutting board. Tian gave it a brisk smack.
Never do it, you great galoot. How many times have you been told?